All right. I am going to pass out some poll data just so we can set the context here. I'll look at that in just a second. Any remaining questions? The outline due date to have it graded on time is Thursday, 3 o'clock. Robin's not here on Friday, so if I don't get them Thursday, then I don't get them. Questions? Alrighty. Today we're going to talk, we're entering the genetics section of the class for 2 weeks. We'll be talking about this week abortion, next week stem cells. Some very famous papers, and this one probably the most, I think arguably at least one of the top five famous papers in bioethics or philosophical bioethics of all times. This is a piece by Judith Jarvis Thompson. She was a professor at MIT. She is famous for her work on rights, and rights are a very particular subspecies of moral category. They are a very high bar in terms of moral obligation, what we owe to others, very high bar. And so she's going to try to think through the question of a right to abortion or the right of a fetus to not be killed or to not have that pregnancy terminated. Many important things, interesting things to learn from this piece. In addition to just what she says about abortion, I think what she says about abortion, the lessons she gives us about abortion are have stood the test of time. And what I mean by that is, what does it mean to argue in favor of abortion when you make certain, when you have certain moral commitments at the start? Now, one of the things we're going to get to understand today is why the abortion debate in this country has gone on for so long without any really significant movement. If you look at your little poll data here, look to the bottom where I've got the green and the red, you will see numbers bouncing around in a 10-year split there from Gallup, somewhere between 46 to 51% labeling themselves pro-choice, and 41 to 51 labeling themselves pro-life. That is some movement, but by and large, it reflects the exact same stability in this debate that has existed for all these years since the early 70s. So despite many, many years of, well, you can count because you know that Roe versus Wade was 1973 and it's 2011. In all those years of permissive abortion law, that is a right to abortion in the first trimester on demand federally, it hasn't moved the percentages pro-life and pro-choice at all. And Judith Jarvis Thompson is going to help us understand why. Her philosophical argument gets to the very root of why this is such a contentious issue in the United States and why we have seen very little movement in all of this time. And my guess is we will see very little in the future, but that's an autumn prediction. I don't think there's going to be any game changer on it, and I think Judith Jarvis Thompson is going to explain why. That's one thing she does. Second thing she does in this article is help us understand how arguments are made, how they are strategically engaged in, and that'll be in stark contrast to next week, when you are trying to persuade your opponent. She's brilliant at understanding her opponent and playing with the premises, the assumptions, and the views and commitments of the opponent. And that's a mistake novices and experts both make, where they don't pay attention to the opponent and the opponent's values, believing that they could actually sway the opponent on his or her values and then also get them to another side. She's going to show us, she's going to demonstrate how the argument that is intended to persuade must play on the turf of the opponent, has to play on the court of the opponent, and not a different game from the opponent. So we'll learn a lot about that. Then we will see how a thought experiment functions. She has used a thought experiment that has become very famous, more famous than the drowning child in the bathtub that James Rachels used. Anyone in bioethics, anyone in philosophy, if you say violinist in the context of medical ethics, everyone knows you're talking about Judith Jarvis Thompson. It's that famous. And it serves a gestalt shift purpose in this piece, not superfluous at all. Actually, the anchor of the very gist of the paper, the core insight. And finally, what we're going to understand is that if you start with particular, and this is overlapping achievements in this article, but if you start with from a particular place on the central question here, is the fetus a person? Does life begin at conception? If you start with the answer yes, you can probably allow abortion in very, very few cases. Yes, perhaps in a few, but you can't get from the fetus is a person to abortion on demand. And I think that is exactly why we're in the place that we're in terms of the contentious issue. I'm not saying that premise is right or wrong. I'm saying if you start there, you end there. And that's what she's going to show us today. Because if anybody can start with a premise and get us to a different kind of place, you're in great hands with Judith Jarvis Thompson. And she gets a very small distance in terms of permitting abortion rights when she starts with that particular premise. So there's lots that we're going to get to see today. Alrighty, structurally, we're going to talk about some opening moves, and then we're going to look at the argument that most folks who are pro-life use. She's going to argue there's actually a more authentic version of that argument that is instead of three steps, it's actually a six-step argument. We will be diagramming that six-step argument, and then we'll be looking for where the problem, how problematic is, are all the premises, do they all hang together? She's going to argue there is a problem in one of the steps. And we'll look at the thought experiment. Then we're going to look at two different moments that correspond to our standard questions about is abortion permissible to save the life of the mother and rape or incest. So we'll be looking at both of those two moments, and that's for sexual relations that are not consensual. And then we'll look at consensual. And she believes she will assess her own argument as much, much weaker when it comes to consensual sex and an unwanted pregnancy, even when it's failed birth control. By the time you get to no use of birth control and an awareness of the biological facts, she is basically going to conclude that there's almost no justification whatsoever for abortion if you start with the premise that life begins at conception. And then we will do some twists on the case, and we'll end with thinking about whether there's a difference between something you ought to do and something you have a right to do, or there's some higher bar, somebody has a right to ask it of you, rather than somebody having a request that makes you ought to do it but not demanded to do it. That's how we'll end. Alrighty, and I have a sore throat, so we'll see where we end up here. All right, so she is going to write this article in 1971. Historically in the United States, that is, of course, very important because it's 2 years prior to Roe. So one of the things that you feel in this argument is the illegality of abortion in most parts of the country. So she, when she gets to a certain part in the argument, she'll say, is there any class of action that would require our behaving in a way that where we can't defend our own life, for example, or our own bodies? And then she says, yes, there is one class of behavior, and it's this, it's abortion. So she's very much writing from a time when she feels that it's a moral imperative to have a right to abortion. She is going to, because she's going to start from a different place, she's going to end from a different place, but what she wants to see is, can someone who calls oneself pro-life see that there would be justification for abortion? She believes that there is justification, and if there is, then she believes it should be legal in all 50 states, which happens 2 years later. All right. Take a look at the sheet that I handed. Everybody got one? Let me put up a stack over here. We are a tiny but mighty group today. All right. Take a look at that top poll there, where I've got it in blue. This is an ABC Washington Post poll that asks whether abortion ought to be illegal in all cases. Whenever any pollster asks someone if abortion ought to be illegal in all cases, they are absolutely talking about save the life of the mother and rape and incest, and they tend to be lumped together. Especially in our contemporary discussions today, these 40 years later, we always say life of the mother, rape and incest. It's just one big pot, and that's what people mean. And what you're going to see there is that 15 to 17% of Americans still believe, hold to the belief, that abortion isn't permissible even to save the life of the mother or even in the case of rape. It's that portion of folks who are pro-life that she's addressing in this piece, because it's actually not the majority, by any means the majority of folks who would consider themselves pro-life who hold that view. In other words, if you look, I think I need less air conditioning to get through. Olivia, do you mind? As the throat is burning, shivering on top could be bad. If you look at the numbers of people who are pro-life, 45%, that doesn't reflect believing that abortion should be illegal in all cases. They don't line up. They don't line up because, in some ways, Judith Jarvis Thompson already won. In other words, what she's arguing in this piece is that even if you are pro-life, by which I mean you start with the premise that life begins at conception, even you can be seen, can be shown to see, that's her argument, can be shown to see that abortion is permissible in the case of rape, incest, and saving the life of the mother. So many, many people now who are pro-life agree with Judith Jarvis Thompson. Most people who are pro-life agree with Judith Jarvis Thompson. That wasn't likely the case in 1971, though I don't have the poll data to show it. Now, and in fact, even the Catholic Church at the time took a hard stance, which it's hard, you're hard-pressed to find priests who would advocate, who would think it was morally imperative that a woman die to avoid an abortion. So there's been a huge shift. Nevertheless, there are still 15% of Americans who hold that view. Now, if the polls were more subtle and teased apart rape, incest on the one hand and life of the mother on another, that would give us a little bit more information. In other words, one of the things that I would argue, one of the things I would hypothesize, is that you would have far fewer who would say that a woman should die rather than have an abortion if it's truly a life threat. More of that group would say rape and incest is a different category than the life of the mother, though through no fault of the woman is she pregnant. So that statistic lumps something that is more subtle in differentiation, and I couldn't find a poll data that actually asked specific questions. If I looked harder, maybe it was there. All right. So let's start with her philosophical prowess or genius. It's starting with what I'm going to call the metaphysical first premise. Metaphysical is a Greek word that means meta here, above, and physika, the physical, above the physical. And it means above what could be empirically demonstrated, shown, or proven. It doesn't mean that a view that you have that is metaphysical is wrong. It means it can't be shown to be true or false. And the abortion debate, the abortion arguments from both sides start with metaphysical first premises, from claims that cannot be definitively proven, true or false, either way. So, for example, if you are pro-choice, you start with the claim that life begins at conception or the fetus is a person. There's no way to prove to someone on the other side that the fetus is a person, because as you start, you will already be defining what personhood means. And part of personhood will be the start of human life. So if the fetus is the start of human life and that's what personhood is, then of course you have personhood in the fetus. But how are you going to argue to someone who believes that a few-celled organism is actually a human being of the same type and stripe as someone who's out and crying, and or even has human form later on in the pregnancy. It's not going to be any way to prove it. It doesn't mean that the claim's not right. It means you can't show it. On the other side, people who are pro-choice start with the antithetical metaphysical premise. That is not a person. Again, how are you going to show someone that it is or is not a person? So there are a set of metaphysical claims that often begin arguments, like there is God, or there is no God, or where the line gets drawn between what is a human being and not a human being. These are fundamental anchoring beliefs that we don't have quite on faith, but we certainly don't have them from science. Science may influence how we come to our metaphysical anchoring beliefs, but once we have that anchoring belief, no amount of science is going to shake you from it. So you have very renowned scientists who believe in God, and very renowned scientists who don't, and very renowned scientists who are pro-life, and very renowned scientists who are pro-choice. I'm only using the scientists as an example because we often think science can be the arbiter. It can make the decision and the distinction between various claims. Science has no role here, has no place in terms of being the arbiter. And so, when you're thinking about abortion, you are talking about two groups of people who are starting from antithetical first premises, and there isn't anything you can do to shake them from it. Either way. And that's why you can't even get on the same court with somebody who's got the antithetical metaphysical first premise to the one you hold. How would you convince me that a fetus is a person or is not a person? How would you start? What would you do? It's not that you'd be silent, it's that what you would say wouldn't work. It wouldn't have any effect on me. And that's why we understand it to be a metaphysical, above science, beyond reason and rationality, more of a faith or a claim that is too deep or too beyond rational argumentation. So, she understands that. And yet, who is her opponent here? The opponent is the person who is, I think she calls the person extreme, but it doesn't. What I mean by that is just on the continuum of permissibility of abortion, the person way over on the continuum of never permissible. So I don't mean anything pejorative by the word extreme, just on the one far end of the continuum, no abortion ever. That's who her opponent is. That's not Judith Jarvis' position. So she's going to try to talk to people who are on the other end of the spectrum. And to do that, she is going to need to start on their own turf, on their own court. And so, she has to begin with the way they begin. Every fetus is a person. If you started with the antithetical first premise there, what would the premise be? You started with the premise that Judith Jarvis Thompson starts with. What would the premise be for your first opener in an abortion debate? This is an easy question. Yes. Fetus is not a person. It's just not a person. Right. In fact, if you believe in abortion on demand, and many of you do, you couldn't possibly start with the premise, every fetus is a person. Because you don't hold the view, I'm certain you don't, that any baby could be killed. Because in your view, a baby is a person. And you don't willy-nilly murder people. So if you actually thought, those of you who are pro-choice, if you actually thought the fetus was no different from a baby, you would immediately not be pro-choice. Everything about abortion rights and your view of abortion hangs on this first premise. You can't justify abortion on demand. I don't mean in rape, incest, and the life of the mother. She's going to try to argue, starting with that premise, you can get to abortion for the life of the mother and rape and incest. But on demand, because your birth control didn't work or because you didn't use birth control, and there's a baby, we should suffocate it, you'd never agree to it. So whenever you think about the metaphysical first premise, this is going to be very important for next week's class, whenever you think about that metaphysical first premise, if it's not your own, because some of you are not pro-life, if it's your own, you get it. You get it in a core. You get it deeply. If that is not your view, substitute in the word baby every time you see the word fetus. because you're going to need to have that level of power in that first premise to understand what the pro-life position actually is. That's how big a difference it is. If you're pro-choice, you don't think you're talking about a baby. If you're pro-life, you think that you are. And that is a huge difference in how is that argument going to start. So she knows she has to start with every fetus is a person if she's going to have any hope of convincing people who are pro-life to have abortion in any circumstances, even very rare circumstances. She can't start with a premise that isn't the premise of that camp. And that's true of all effective bioethical arguments, philosophical arguments too. If you start with a radically different premise from the person you're playing, that you're arguing with, you're basically playing a different game. You're playing tennis, they're playing basketball, see how that works at the end of the day. So she's going to have to start with a metaphysical premise, and her question is this. If I start with the premise of the pro-life, how much abortion right can I get out of that premise? And she's going to find very, very little. The kind of range, the kind of permissibility for abortion that our poll data shows most pro-lifers actually agree you can get out of that premise. In other words, the majority of folks who are pro-life believe that you can have an abortion. Not everybody. We see that 15% or 18% say no. But there's far more than that who are anti-abortion. We see that in the end, there is wiggle room on the pro-life side, rape, incest, life of the mother. Alrighty. And this is prior to our understanding that by poll data, Judith Jarvis-Thompson makes complete sense of this statistic. But what she's going to argue about those in yellow is that if they were exposed to her argument, that number of 15, 18, 16, 17% would be lower. She believes she can convince that group, because most of the people in that group she's already convinced, or arguments like it. Questions so far about what we're doing? Okay. My throat hurts. Alrighty. The opponent of abortion believes that there is an argument that definitively shows abortion is wrong in all cases, and it's a three-step argument. Every fetus is a person. Every person has a right to life. Therefore, that's our little signal that we're wrapping up an argument. Therefore, every fetus has a right to life. It's a perfect syllogism. She argues that this is too quick. This is what pro-lifers think is their argument. But she argues you can actually extend this argument. You need to extend this argument. And when you extend the argument, you can see that there's more to it than just this very simple equation. And so the argument goes on. For all A and B, philosophers love this. Those are placeholders. Just like when we did the doctrine of double effect, we said that for any act X, and then we went on, if it's merely intended in that same act X, if it's foreseen or whatever, placeholders, that's all that is. For all A and B, if B has a right to life, then A's intentionally ending B's life is morally wrong, unless the killing of B serves some right of A. I'll explain all this. That is of at least as much moral importance as B's A and B for all women and fetuses. If B, the fetus, has a right to life, then A, the woman's intentionally ending B's life, that is having an abortion, is morally wrong unless the killing of B, the killing of that fetus, serves some right of the woman, is granting some inherent right of the woman that is at least as important as B's right to life. It has to be equivalent in its power of rights. So it can't be trivial. It's going to have to be as powerful as B's claim that B has a right to life, because that is very powerful. And then, five, substitute all this in. Therefore, and now I am just going to do the substitution, so it's the exact same premise, but now adding in mother and fetus, so we keep it straight. Intentionally ending a fetus's life is morally wrong unless it serves some right of the mother that is at least as important as the fetus's right to life. And that's just a substitute in there into a concrete case into four. What is the right that pro-choicers are going to say is the right that enables a woman to have an abortion on demand? What is that right? Classic. Everybody uses it. Mm-hmm.
Autonomy.
Yes, but they say it very specifically. It is autonomy. They say it's the right.
Control over.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's not that it's classic. This is exactly what a pro-choicer is going to say. And so the pro-lifer is going to say, one person's right to life necessarily, always, in every case, outweighs a person's right, another person, a different person's right to control her body. They are not parallel. That is what a pro-lifer is going to say. Yes, normally you get to control your own body, but you don't get to control your own body if somebody else's life is at stake. That's why when you start with the metaphysical premise, every fetus is a person, your immediate objection to the pro-choicers is the argument about controlling your own body. Because you've got a baby at stake. You've got a life at stake here. And somebody's right to have that life is bigger than your de facto normal circumstance of being able to control your own body. Yeah, you should be able to get a tattoo if you want it, or pierce yourself, or whatever you want, or take a risk skydiving. It's your right to control your own body, but not if it's going to kill somebody else. That's what the pro-choicers say. One person's right to life outweighs your right to control your own body. And that makes perfect sense if the fetus is a person. Therefore, abortion is wrong. Unless it serves a bigger right of the woman than control of her body. It's got to be bigger than that. That is the classic pro-choice, pro-life argument. Now, if you're pro-life, you ought to recognize yourself in that. In other words, if Judith Jarvis Thompson is going to talk to you, those of you who are pro-life, if that's who she's talking to, and you don't recognize yourself in that argument, that doesn't sound like your argument, she has a big problem right out of the starting gate. That's the same issue you're facing right now as you do the PAS argument. As you are pro-PAS, or anti-PAS. Let's say right now you're anti-PAS. And I do not recognize my pro-PAS side being depicted in your outline or vice versa. You're dead before you've even started. Because the only person that matters when you're writing a piece is the one on the other side. And if I can't see myself, if you've got some straw man, that's the word we use, you build up the opponent in a way that is so flimsy that you can nail the opponent very easily, and you can dispense of the opponent's position very quickly. The only problem is the opponent can't see herself in that position. You may look like you've got philosophical prowess and have been victorious at the end of the day. What you've actually done is just get the opponent to stop listening to you altogether. So she's got to make sure she's got a very good pro-life argument up here, and she believes she does. That said, when a philosopher is going to attack an argument, remember how arguments work. Every premise, if the argument is valid, and all professional philosophers, certainly whose pieces have lasted this long, are giving valid arguments, if it's valid, it's going to follow logically to the conclusion. That's just got to be. It's just going to be built tightly. And so you're not going to be able to just say, wait, you forgot the premise that was in between. They're not going to be susceptible to that. It's going to be a lock-tight argument. But that does not mean it's true. So this, she's arguing, is the pro-life argument. But she does not believe it's true. What doesn't she believe is true? She believes that the conclusion isn't true. What would it mean for this conclusion to not be true? What is another way to state abortion is wrong unless it serves a bigger picture, a bigger right than the control of the woman's control over her body? What would it mean for that conclusion to be wrong? Give me Judith Jarvis Thompson's conclusion. What does it mean to deny that conclusion? It means to have what as your conclusion? My handwriting is very bad at that point. But you wrote it down. Abortion is morally wrong unless it serves some greater right of the mother than the right to control her own body. Judith Jarvis Thompson believes that is false. So if it's false, how would she restate it as true? What does she think is true? What would the true conclusion be on Judith Jarvis Thompson? How would you take premise number 7, conclusion 7, point 7, and say, what is Judith Jarvis Thompson's position?
So, a woman's right to control of her own body makes it morally...
Is sometimes
makes abortion morally acceptable?
Right. That's right. So what she's going to argue is it is not always the case that the right to control your own body is smaller than somebody else's right to life. Sometimes it's big enough to make abortion permissible. So she believes that number 7 is false. Sometimes the right to control your own body actually is bigger than somebody else's right to life. And she believes she can get there from every fetus as a person. Because if she just gets off that metaphysical premise, of course you would think that your right to control your body is bigger than some other thing that matters but isn't a person. She needs to show, even if you're talking about the life of a person, the right to control your own body can, at times, justify killing that other person. And she's not going to mince words. People who are pro-choice are like, well, it's not called killing because in this, it has to be. If the fetus is a person, you're talking about killing a fetus. So let's not pussyfoot around. If that's your premise, that's what it means. Pro-choicers don't talk like that. They don't have to because they don't think they're killing anybody. They think that they are terminating a potentiality, not a person. But if she's going to get this premise through, she's going to start with this metaphysical premise and show the conclusion's wrong. She's just going to have to look it square on and say, no, you are killing a fetus. But you can do that sometimes. Even on grounds of the woman's controlling her own right to her own body in certain very limited cases. Now, in order to do that, if she's going to show that premise number 7, conclusion 7, is false, she's going to have to do that by finding one of the 6 premises to be false. Which is the premise that she's going to go after? Well, 4 doesn't say anything. 4 just says that if there are these two rights, then A has to have a right that's just as big as B. So it can't be number 4, because that just says it's got to be as big as a right to life. A and B both have to have the same power of right, the right that's as big as the right to life.
Number five.
Five is the restatement of four, so we're narrowing it down. If it can't be four, it can't be five. She's going to go after number six. Let me explain again why, and then we'll just work on number six. Four says that four lets open the possibility that sometimes the right to control your own body is as big a right as B. It doesn't say it isn't. So in structure, there's nothing wrong with four. Four allows the possibility of six, because six is the one that says that that person's right to control your own body can never be as big a right. Four and five don't actually say that the right to control your own body is too small to rise up to the level of protecting the right to life. It doesn't state it. It just says it has to be as big. Six is the one that says, well, it isn't as big. The right to control your own body isn't as big. And she's going to argue, yes, it is. It can be. It isn't always. It can be. All right. So she is going to go after number six. And tell me how she's going to go after number six. It's going to have to do with the thought experiment. How is that going to go? How's the thought experiment go? Remember it? Violinist? Oh my God, we are all so tired.
You are kidnapped and you have a blood match to a world famous violinist whose kidneys are not functioning. You are connected to him through some tubes, and essentially his blood is being filtered through your kidneys.
And you're basically a dialysis machine, as a matter of fact, right?
Yeah.
And what did you do to deserve getting hooked up this way? What did you do?
Was it like walking through an alley or something?
No, you didn't, did you? I don't think so. Didn't you just go to a concert? If you went through an alley, you got what you deserved, because alleys are dark. No, you didn't go through an alley. You were as innocent as you could possibly be. I thought you were just at a concert and you got nabbed. You didn't do anything that somebody could say was unsafe, wasn't cautious, didn't protect yourself, was foolish. All you did was what everybody else at any time would have done, just very normal, went to the concert, got kidnapped, and there you go. You didn't do anything that could even be a reflection at all on your behavior. You didn't invite it. You didn't ask for it. You were completely without fault that this happened to you. And now you have this violinist hooked up to you. And the violinist is going to have to be hooked up to you for a very long time. And you don't know him. And you have no connection to him. You have no prior relationship to him. Nothing. It's just something that happened, and now you're saddled with it. That said, if you unplug him, which you can, and he can't stop you, if you unplug him, he will die. Now, she wants you to get in that thought experiment where suddenly you've got somebody hooked up to you, a perfect stranger hooked up to you, and you can unplug the person or you can endure it for all this time. Now, what she wants to know is not would you endure, would you keep him connected, but are you obligated to keep him connected? That is a big difference, because sometimes in your life you will do things that you are not obligated to do, but charitably you will do. We call that the supererogatory. It's above and beyond the call of duty, the supererogatory. That is much higher than the obligatory, which is higher yet than the permissible. The permissible, you're not mandated to do. The obligatory, you are mandated to do. The supererogatory is even higher and loftier morally, but you couldn't be said to be mandated. Martyrdom, for example. You're not mandated to be a martyr, but we praise you if you are. We call those who engage in the supererogatory our heroes. And we wouldn't call you a hero if you just did what had to be done. So she uses the example. For example, you hear of somebody in a crisis. Kitty Genevieve is the example she gives, very famous case where there's a bystander problem. But at any rate, it doesn't matter. You witness an accident, and what is obligatory is that you call 911. Of course, you have to call 911. That's just what morality demands. If you stop by the side of the road to give CPR, that's above and beyond the call of duty. We think you're a hero for doing it, but we don't think that you are a moral rogue and a creep if you don't do it. But if you don't call 911, we think it's a pretty scathing indictment of you as a person. So that's the difference between morality and supererogatory, going above and beyond the call of duty. Go back to the violinist. She's asking, must you keep the violinist connected to you? Or may you? In other words, will you be a hero if you do? And so some of you will say, I'll do it. But she's not asking that. She's not asking, well, when you think about the question, can you keep him connected to you? Will you do it? That shows already that there's an option. Yes, you say, I will do it. It will be a sacrifice, but I will do it. Is not the same question as, must you do it? The question she's asking is, must you keep that violinist connected to you? Must you? And if you don't, you are as scum, morally, as the person who doesn't call 911. As much as the person who picks up a wallet on the street and takes the money out rather than trying to hunt down the owner to get the wallet back. It's at that level. Are you that person if you unplug the violinist? Or do you just fail to be a hero? Is it just something that you're not a martyr on? Which is it? So I ask you. And it's not just you, because in some ways, when you run a thought experiment, you can say to yourself, well, I hold myself to the highest level of virtue. That's not the way I want you to run this thought experiment. What I want you to say is, of people you care about, for example, would you no longer be able to respect them if they said, I'm sorry, it's tragic, but I have to unplug this person? Because you never look at somebody the same who can't spend a few minutes calling 911 to save somebody's life. You're like, okay, you're not the person I thought you were. So now I ask you about the thought experiment. If the person, if your friends or other people in the world, if they say, I'm sorry, but I can't do it. I've got to unplug the violinist. I can't have that. The violinist hooked up to me for all this time. I just can't. Do you say, well, I don't know how I'll ever respect you again. You must. You beg them. You must keep them hooked up. Or would you say, I understand that, even if you would keep them hooked up? And so, poll. Do you think it's obligatory? Everyone must. You're a moral scoundrel if you don't. You must keep the violinist hooked up. Right here. Oh, well, there you go. So she won. So what she did was she tried to get you to think about something that had nothing to do with abortion, to think about whether one person's right to life, the violinist, necessarily outweighs your right to control your own body. And you all said, as sad as it is, the violinist doesn't actually have a right to my body, though it would be great if we could get the violinist someplace else, maybe, to some other dialysis machine and not me. I do not have an obligation to do it, though I may be a hero if I do. Now, she knows that this thought experiment is a description of one very particular circumstance someone might find themselves in an abortion case, and that case is what? Right. This is supposed to be a classic thought experiment to help you get from rape to the right to have an abortion in the case of being forced to have the activity pushed on you that resulted in this pregnancy. Through no will of your own, no fault of your own, someone, even if, you know, the fetus is a person because we're on the pro-life side, someone is depending on you for life, but you did nothing to bring it about. She's arguing, when you translate this back to abortion, the fetus does not have a claim on you. Would it be great for the fetus if everybody could win? Sure. But do you have the right to say, I'm sorry, I didn't ask for this, and therefore I don't have the obligation? She believes you do. So her thought experiment is anchoring, just inherently trying to anchor the case of rape. Now, She wants to back up a little bit and talk, before she talks about rape, to talk about the case of the life of the mother. Because she understands that there'll be some folks who are pro-life who will not think in number four, forget premise number six. When you fill in for premise number four, that B has to have the same level of right as A, what if you filled in for A and B? They both need this for life. So A has a right to life and B has a right to life. Well, the people who believe that abortion isn't permissible even then believe that B's right trumps A's right to life, even if it's right to life, right to life. So the first thing she wants to do is take up the question of whether you can actually make the claim filling in here for at number four when both people have the same right. It's still the right to life in both cases. Because that's the one she thinks is going to be easiest to refute. And she does that by doing what?
By explaining killing and letting
die. It is. And what's the thought experiment going to... How's the thought experiment going to do the work here? What do we have to picture about the violinist? To worry about life of the mother, how do we have to tweak the violinist case? You don't even have to read it. Just think about it.
Basically, you giving up your kidneys to the violinist is killing you.
Yes. Imagine that the violinist being attached to you is actually killing you. It's creating a problem so severe that you're going to die by having the violinist hooked up. Now, you weren't that fond of the violinist, even when the violinist wasn't going to damage you. He was just going to inconvenience you for a long time. If you didn't think that you had an obligation to keep him connected when he wasn't going to hurt you, pretty much guaranteed that when he is going to hurt you, you're surely going to unplug him. If he's killing you, you believe, my guess is, that you are not obligated to keep him connected to you. And the reason is at the very least, self-defense. But let's say that that's not the experiment that helps you, because in a way, you can't get the innocence of a child analogizing with the violinist. Somehow you can't. For that, then, the innocence of the child, because of course the fetus, regardless of whether it's rape, incest, or the fetus threatening the mother's life, you couldn't possibly put any blame on the fetus. The fetus has no intention. The fetus didn't want you raped. The fetus doesn't want you to die. In fact, the fetus very much doesn't want you to die, at least certainly not for 9 months. So you can't put any blame on the fetus. The fetus is wholly innocent in this. So she concocts another thought experiment to demonstrate that you have the same intuition about self-defense, even if it involves an innocent child. And so what is her thought experiment that helps us there? I think because we're all doing our outlines, we have not all had a chance to do the reading, and I understand that. Believe me, I love to get up here and talk, so if you don't guess right, I'll just fill it in for you. At least you came, right? The rest of the people didn't read it, and they didn't come, right? Right? There should be 50 people in this room. So we commend you, even though you haven't had time to do the reading today, and I understand that. Does an inflatable doll ring a bell? No. Okay. That's okay. Everybody got to page two. Okay. So from now on, it's just going to be autumn talking, and we will just get in and out and home to our outlines. It's all good. And I will rest my throat with Sucrates. So imagine that you are in a fairly small house, like a shed, basically, or a doll's house. Not a doll's house, but a playhouse. You know, like a playhouse. They're about like this. You got a duck if you're an adult. You can go in there. You're in a thing like that, but it's all enclosed. And you are there with a child. Very innocent child. The child isn't doing anything. It doesn't mean to do anything. But unfortunately, this is a child that inflates. And like a blow-up doll, inflates and inflates and inflates. You can't get out of the house. You can't get out of the house. And because the walls are so sturdy. And so this inflatable child keeps backing you up to the point where the plastic of the inflatable doll has you hooked up against a wall, which hopefully has no dry erase on it with my white sweater, and it pins you up like this, up against the wall, and you're about to get suffocated, and thank God you have a pin. And the doll inflates. You can breathe, it's all good. Otherwise, you would suffocate. Here's my question. Do you get to put the pin in the child? Or do you have to just let, say, hey, she didn't mean it. She's an innocent child. Bye-bye, world. Do you have to just suffocate? Or can you put the pin in the inflatable child? You're sorry that it had to happen. Now let me put it like this. Maybe you are that kind of person. You're just like, look, I've lived 38 years. Let's say. So I've had 38 years. That child has only had 6 years. So it's fine that I'm going to suffocate to death. I don't know this child. This isn't something I brought in. You know, I didn't want this child. But there it is. And so, fine, I'm just, bye-bye world. Good luck, inflatable child. Maybe you do have that attitude. That's not the point. The point is, if I pinprick the inflatable child so that I can live, do you condemn me? Do you feel that I have violated some sacred right that that child had not to be deflated? No. My guess is no. Sad? Is it tragic? It is. But my life is valuable too, despite the fact that I've had more of it. In fact, in some ways, by utilitarian calculus, the fact that I've actually got other people dependent on me might even give me a leg up from the six-year-old inflatable child. Because I've got two children who are inflatable like that. That, you know, maybe not even inflating, I hope. But that depend on me. So maybe actually in a consequentialist world, I actually have more at stake. And I'm not saying I do. But at the very least, it is one of the core beliefs of most people that you have the right to defend your own life. Self-defense is something most people believe is their inherent right. And maybe if they want to live up at the supererogatory where they would not harm another life, even if their life was at stake, that doesn't mean they think it's obligatory for everyone else. And if they did, they'd be quite out of step with the rest of the human population. Because one of the things that human beings tend to believe is that you are allowed to defend your own life. And self-defense, at least in the United States and in most parts of the world, as far as I understand, is not a punishable offense. So self-defense has already been recognized, even the legal system, as something that you are allowed to do. Kant scholars, Kantians, like me, can defend this position very easily. And they defend it like this. All beings are infinitely worthy. So if you have a being that has infinite worth, and another being that has infinite worth, that's all infinity right there. But I have a special obligation to protect my own life, as you have a special obligation to protect your own life, because you are uniquely qualified to protect your own life in certain dimensions I couldn't possibly protect you on. Like, I can't protect you from eating bad food. If you decide you're going to have nothing but chips day in, day out, day in, day out, the only person who could protect yourself from a poor diet is you. I don't mean that there's no social causes. I mean that if you choose that that's what you're going to eat, what can I do? Only you can protect yourself by exercising or not smoking or eating the right foods or making sure you wear sun lotion or whatever it is. You're uniquely qualified to protect yourself in a way that others couldn't possibly protect you, at least not in adulthood. And that's what gives us the right to defend this. I can defend this and you can defend that. So self-defense is very much even part of a Kantian understanding. And therefore, when it comes to the life of the mother, most people can see that a self-defense argument actually justifies an abortion because it is life for life. And you might say, but wait a minute, if it's life for life, let's just roll the dice about which life wins. Judith Jarvis Thompson's response to that is this. While it is life and life, two lives, only one life is attacking another life. So it's the attacking life, even though that life isn't culpable for the attack, that is the life that has to be stopped. In other words, in the case of the life of the mother, right, that's not the case of rape or incest or elective abortion, but in the case of the life of the mother, when someone has an abortion, because the fetus is threatening the mother's life, the mother wishes that the fetus weren't threatening her life so that everyone could have life. Right? If that's the reason you have an abortion, not, well, the fetus is threatening my life, and I don't actually think the fetus is a person, and I'd rather not have this child, that's not the circumstance I'm talking about. I'm talking about where the only reason you're having an abortion is because the fetus is threatening your life. Well, then you wish that the fetus weren't attacking your life so that you could give the fetus life and also have your life preserved. So her attitude is, if it's the fetus that's attacking the woman, it's the fetus that's got to go. Just like you could say, well, look, somebody's coming at me with a knife, and the police need to stop this, that there's a life against a life. Who's the police going to shoot? The person with the knife or the person standing there trying to get away from the knife? Of course, the person with the knife. So it is true that one person's going to go, the one who's attacking. She admits the fetus isn't trying to attack. Nevertheless, the mother has a right to defend herself, says Judith Jarvis Thompson, because the mother isn't the one who's actually attacking the fetus. All right, that is how she brings, that's how she, at least she tries to get a justification, starting with the premise every fetus is a person, and yet having abortion to save a woman's life. She believes that she's got that one pretty slam dunk. And actually, as I said, if we could tease out the 15 to 17% statistic in that first poll data, which we can't because it's all lumped together, there would be a big difference between people who think the life of the mother shouldn't be, you can't have an abortion even then, versus rape or incest. Different argument. She knows it, so now she's going to turn to rape or incest, which is rape. Okay. She knows that her thought experiment is already... Why do we never have a dry erase board that can actually erase? Other people do have dry erase boards that seem to be able to erase. She knows that what's going to hinge on her ability to criticize number 7 when it comes to rape or incest is going to, it's going to amount to how you define the right to life. And so she says there's 3 possibilities for your meaning when you say the right to life. So questioning premise number 6, one person's right to life, let me underline it, necessarily outweighs another person's right to control her body. She says a lot will depend here in challenging premise number 6 on whether we use one definition or another definition of the right to life. So she says, let's think about the right to life. And let's define it very strongly as the right to the bare minimum needed for existence. She says, some people may say that what it means to have a right to life means to be given whatever it is that is needed to keep you alive. That's what's actually at play. And therefore, a woman has an obligation to give, because every fetus, every person has a right to life and every fetus is a person, because of premise number 2, every person has the right to the bare minimum they need for existence. So that here, once you get down here and you're trying to figure out how do you unseat premise number 6, well, first you got to figure out what does it mean for you to say of me, I have a right to life. So the first one she entertains is maybe what you mean is that I have to give you whatever it is that you need minimally to survive. I have to give you the bare minimum you need to exist. She says she wants to give you another thought experiment. And this is one, you'll like it when you read it, but it won't work particularly well as it stands. It will be hard to get your head around the need for this. And she will show how dated this is, how dated this piece. But she says this. Imagine that you are on your sick bed, and the only way you can survive the illness that you have is to have Henry Fonda come from California and put a cool washcloth on your forehead. That's what you need. Nothing else will do. Now, it's hard to get your head around that, as I said, because first of all, he was dead, and before he was dead, he was 85. So it's hard for us. So think instead, if you're very, very young, of somebody I wouldn't know, and if you're not that young, Brad Pitt or somebody like that, or Angelina Jolie or whatever. I mean, pick somebody that you would actually want to have the cool washcloth on your forehead. And it's not Henry Fonda for sure. If that's really what it would take to keep you alive, do you have the right to obligate Brad Pitt to come from France to be at your bedside? If that's absolutely what you need, nothing else will do. Nothing else could work. Could you actually obligate Brad Pitt? And she says, under no circumstances could you actually say to the guy who doesn't know you, Brad, my friend over there, Autumn, she has to have you come. So you must come. You're like, I don't have to come. I don't know her. I'm sorry. Sorry she's a whack job. Sorry that she's in the circumstance. But no, I don't have to come. That's not the same thing as Brad Pitt saying, oh, what the hell, this will be a great publicity stunt, or, you know, I've got, you know, I do a little pro bono in my life, or I give a little bit, or whatever, like a Make-A-Wish Foundation or whatever. I will come and visit Autumn. That's not the same thing. Sometimes people will go above and beyond the call of duty. That doesn't mean they have to do it. It's absurd to say that just because somebody needs it, somebody else has to give it. So that won't work as a justification for how I have to give the violinist life or a fetus life because I owe that person the bare minimum of existence. If the violinist needs me and can have nothing but me to survive, unfortunately, that doesn't obligate me to take care of the violinist. It just doesn't. Well, then she says, all right, maybe you might say the right to life is the right not to be killed. Well, that would just prove by self-defense couldn't possibly be true. You don't have the right to not be killed. You can, someone else. If you attack me, you can't say, well, wait a minute, Autumn, I know I'm coming after you with a knife. You know, wait a minute, Autumn, I know I'm an inflatable child about to suffocate you, but I've got the right not to be killed. Excuse me, you tried to kill me. So it can't be the case that you have a universal, absolute right not to be killed. Self-defense shows that we don't believe that. We don't believe that it's absolute that people have the right not to be killed. Another context in which we believe people can certainly be killed is in war. We send out our soldiers to go ahead and kill people. So it's not true that we believe that in an absolute right not to be killed, otherwise there'd be no war, there'd certainly be no death penalty, and there'd be no self-defense. So no, we don't think that. Well, then it must mean, and this is the crux she will use, you have the right not to be killed unjustly. So everything about this right is going to hinge on the right not to be killed unjustly. When we think then about what does it mean for someone to obligate me and to have a justice claim on me, to say, you owe me this, Autumn, you'd have to show that I have some special obligation to you. And what she wants to argue here is the fact that you happen to somehow get inside me doesn't mean that you have squatter's rights to me. It depends on how you got there. If you got there because I was kidnapped by the Society of Music Lovers and you hooked me up without my will, I never invited you in, so I never set up any obligation to you. Imagine if a couple of children just come and they plop themselves down in your home and they say, I've arrived. You don't know them. Their names are Sue and Jen. And they just plop themselves in your apartment and they say, I'm here. You have to take care of me. You would say, I have to call the police. I have to get you to the Child Protective Services. I don't have to keep you in my home. You never invited any relationship between, any parental relationship. You did nothing to invite that level of obligation. The children cannot say back to you, but you have to help me. Well, I have to get you to somebody else maybe because there is an option. With pregnancy, we don't have that option. But at least we don't right now, and that's one of the things we want to talk about when we get down to the bottom there. At this point, though, there is no way to get those children to some other place. Does it mean that you have an obligation? You don't, she says, because you never had any kind of relationship that would set up these kind of obligations. To say that somebody is doing something unjustly to you or that you are doing something unjustly to somebody else, they have to be able to have a justice claim against you. And so they have to be able to say, you owe me this. You're obligated to do this for me. But under what circumstance could the violinist say to the woman, you owe me this? How could I owe you? In fact, one of the most wonderful pieces that was written in the late 20th century, in the 90s, was a book by Tim Scanlon, who's alive and well at Harvard, and the book is called What We Owe to Each Other. It was an explanation of our moral life based on what we do owe each other. For example, I promise to be here and teach this class on Tuesdays and Thursdays, as is stated on the syllabus. I owe you being there. But I don't owe Jonathan's class anything. I don't owe them to be in their class. I don't owe Lance's class to be there on Wednesdays. How? I didn't make any promise. I have no obligation. Obligations come because of promises or contracts or some type of relationship that sets up a what I owe. If the violinist gets himself attached to me without my doing anything, how could I possibly owe? Analogized, how could I owe the fetus anything? I didn't do anything to invite the fetus in. And so she's arguing, I can't be accused of killing the fetus unjustly. I set up nothing that would give me an obligation to that fetus. It's just fate, destiny, crime, assault, whatever your explanation is that the fetus got there, it wasn't through anything I did at all, in any way, that would set up an obligation that would enable that person to have a justice claim. So she ends this section by saying, "My right to life, your right to life can't outweigh my right to control my own body if you're in my body and I didn't do anything to set up an obligation to get you there. In fact, I have a right to my own body that trumps your right to life. I just don't have an obligation to you. So I can't be accused of being unjust." All right. So this is how she argues against the sixth premise and argues that, in fact, abortion in a very limited set of cases is justifiable, even though the fetus is a person, and calling a spade, you are killing a person by doing what you're going to do. And then that takes her to the much more common area of circumstance surrounding abortion, and that's when you have consensual sex. So now, the violinist will not work at all. Any questions before we move to the consensual? So she knows the violinist is a rape case, just as she knows the inflatable doll is a life of the mother case, inflatable child. Okay, now she says, let's look at by far and away the majority of requests for abortion. They're about pregnancy that has resulted from consensual sex. Two types. One, where you use birth control but it failed on you, as it can 1 to 3% of the time, despite your best efforts, or when you didn't use any birth control at all. And she wants to see, remember where we are, you're starting with the premise every fetus is a person, she have a baby here. You knew that there were people pods that floated in the world. They were like marigold seeds that kind of float in the air. And then when they land in the ground, a marigold can start. And you know that. So you have windows. You don't want to live your whole life with your windows nailed shut. So you have windows, but you have a very fine mesh screen to keep the people pods from coming through the mesh screen. And 97 to 99% of the time, those little seeds of the marigolds and whatever, those people seeds, they can't get through. They're blocked by the mesh screen. So it's true that you could be accused of not keeping your windows locked tight for your entire life. Short of that, though, it's a very, very, very low risk. Given, though, there is some risk, she asks, have you set up an obligation by knowing that you're engaging in an activity, opening the window and putting a mesh screen, aka having sex with birth control, that isn't foolproof? Does that knowledge, that it is absolutely the case that there is some risk, does that knowledge set up a concern here that the fetus's right to life does outweigh your right to control your own body because you knowingly engaged in something that sets up the possibility of having the people plant in your carpet, in your body, and therefore you actually do have an obligation. So her claim that in the case of rape, incest, and life of the mother, that a fetus isn't killed unjustly, does it still work when you actually set up an invitation, not an intentional one, but your very action set up a kind of invitation? Does that mean you have a kind of obligation? And so if you set up an obligation because you took a risk with eyes wide open, does that mean that you can't turn around and say, well, I'm not doing anything unjust. I didn't want this to happen. Well, you didn't want it to happen, but you knew it could happen. And because you knew it could happen, you were taking the consequence that there'd be an obligation and a consequence if it did happen, given that you're now going to kill somebody because you took a risk that something, that there could be an obligation. What do you think? Here's what she thinks. She thinks it's gray at the very best. One of the questions you have to ask yourself is this. Do you condemn people to suffer the consequences when they take a risk that is between 1 and 3%? In human activity, is that the level of chance taking that we turn around and say, well, you knew there was a 99% chance it wouldn't happen and a 1% chance that it would, and you did it anyway? Do we condemn people when they only have a 1% chance of something bad happening? Or do we say, that's just the reasonable amount of risk that people ought to be allowed to take, and it doesn't set up an obligation? Because in a minute, we're going to talk about how you have, if you are a healthy woman of prime childbearing age and you're not using birth control, what are your odds? Like 80% will be pregnant in a year or something crazy like that? I mean, it's very high. So once you're not talking about any birth control at all, and you believe the fetus is a person, you'd be like, well, look, if you want to control your own body, get the mesh screen, folks. I mean, you can't act like this isn't the way that it happens and then say, well, I didn't want it to happen. Well, I'm sorry, you don't kill babies because you were reckless. So when it comes to birth control that's failed, you can't be called reckless. Can you be called, though, someone who took a small but definite and known risk? This is what she thinks. Consensual sex, birth control failure, when you believe the fetus is a person, it's going to be pretty iffy. So when you get to no birth control at all, which is what we're talking about, right? Most elective abortions today are requested for individuals who were not either using birth control or weren't using it the way they knew it really had to be used. They're like, well, I don't think today would be a day. You know, I think today we can get away with it. It was that kind of thing. Or, yeah, just, you know, it happened and I wasn't using birth control or whatever. Right? Those are the prime cases of abortion now. For those cases, when you're talking about killing a baby, because you were like, I don't know, I'm going to roll the dice. Sure, it's 50-50, but you're never going to be able to anchor abortion on demand from the fetus as a person. So in the case of the life of the mother, she thinks it's definitive. In the case of rape or incest, she thinks it's pretty damn definitive. When it comes to consensual sex, failed birth control, she feels there's a little argument there. The mesh screen, you tried. Do we blame people when there's a 1% to 3% risk? Are you supposed to live your life in a 100% risk-free environment? She knows that those are some arguments. Remember how I talked to you once about how, I know when I did the physician strike paper, I said, look, there are times when I've made an argument. I don't think it's slam dunk, but I'll give it the old college try. That's her on failed birth control. When it comes to no birth control, you have no ground when you're talking about killing babies. Because you knew, because you did something that was going to have a high likelihood of setting up an obligation for you, and you didn't do anything to prevent it, and now you're telling me it's not unjust when I shirk my obligation? It's like I make a promise to you, but I think that you're only going to hold me to it 50% of the time. Well, when you do, I have to honor it, because I knew that it was a 50% chance that I was going to have to be held to honor my promise. All right. That takes her to the consensual sex. Summary so far, she thinks that you can start with a pro-life position of believing that the fetus is a person, life begins at conception, and still get abortion for the life of the mother, rape, and incest. She does not believe you're going to get elective abortion at all. She doesn't think it's going to be anywhere close. And that explanation explains, in my mind, why we are where we are. If 50% of Americans start with this fundamental premise, then 50% of Americans are not going to believe in abortion on demand. But far more than 50% will believe in abortion for rape, life of the mother, and incest. Oh, in fact, we have 85% of Americans believing that abortion is permissible in those cases. So not only does it seem to me that she's got the pro-life position right in terms of the argumentative structure, it seems to have played out quite well in the polls. And my guess is that if we teased out those two numbers, we'd have even stronger numbers in favor of her argument. Okay, but now she wants to ask, and the last part here is, what if it weren't 9 years or 9 months? What if the violinist, oh, you didn't do anything to invite the violinist. We're going back to rape or incest now. What if the violinist needed 1 hour of the use of your kidney, and the chances were very, very high your kidneys would be fine afterwards? Your body would not be harmed. And the violinist needed you for 1 hour. You didn't ask for it. You didn't invite him. You don't know him. You have no obligation. What do we think of the person who will not allow the violinist to stay for an hour, but will unplug instead? What do you think of that person? 1 hour of your time. Let's go with the violinist first. Let's not talk about abortion. Just the violinist.
Huh? I think we think of them much closer to the person who just wouldn't call 911 if they saw someone like dying on the street.
Right. Now, one of the things that she thinks is, do you think this person is selfish and callous, or do you think the person is unjust? She's going to try to tease out a distinction here between what you ought to do and what you have, what the other person has a right to make you do. So she's going to take a pretty hard line on it. She's going to say this: that person is selfish, and I'm not analogizing this to rape yet. We're going to have to think about whether they don't analogize well. I'm talking just about the kidney and the violinist. She says, we might think that person is indecent, selfish, and callous. But if that person pulled the, if the person hooked up to the violinist pulled the plug on the violinist, would we think that that person was a murderer? Should that person go to jail? No. That's what she thinks. So she thinks that, and remember, she's a rights theorist. So she thinks there's a different level. The one hand, we can accuse a person of possessing many vices: selfishness, callousness, self-centeredness, short-sightedness. But that doesn't mean they're murderers. Because her argument is, you know, you still don't have the right, he still doesn't have the right to demand it of you, though we might wish that you had the moral character to save someone's life for such a little inconvenience. That's her view. It's not mandatory in the sense of it would make you a murderer if you didn't do it, but it may not make you the best exemplar of moral life if you don't. That's what she thinks about the violinist. Now, pregnancy doesn't work like that, but let's say it did. Does the case perfectly analogize to abortion? Remember, fetus is a person, in rape or incest. Do you have the same view of the woman who has an abortion for a pregnancy that is only needed for a week or an hour? And if you think differently of the woman who has an abortion in a pregnancy, this is a total thought experiment because it takes 9 months, or at the very least it takes somewhere between 26 and 30 weeks, you know, I mean, even at viability now. But let's imagine it took only a day or an hour or a week. Would you think that the woman who is the victim of rape was callous and self-centered if she had an abortion, given that pregnancy in 52 takes only an hour or a week? And if not, tell me why you think it's different. Uh-huh. You have a thought?
Oh.
No thought. Caroline, you have a thought?
Because with the kidney, it's just that one time deal, whereas if you think of pregnancy, you know, having the child, of like the after.
Yeah, I think that's why a lot of people think it's not an analogy. Because even if you give the baby up for adoption, there is your genetic material, your offspring, mixed with the offspring of a criminal who's assaulted you. So the sequelae, potentially, for the woman, even if the physical pregnancy lasts for a short time, the physical manifestation of a violation could last for a very long time. The argument might be there's just something very different about rape, conception, pregnancy, and a child that does not analogize to somebody in a kidney for an hour. Where that person, you may feel no bond to that person whatsoever. The fact that you have a daughter or a son in the world is at least plausibly a very different experience than a run-in with a violinist for an hour. And so maybe the fact that you would think ill of the person who wouldn't let somebody have their body for an hour to save their life when it was no fault of that person that they needed your body, you may actually not have that view. Certainly you wouldn't think it was obligatory, but you probably wouldn't have that view of a woman who said, I'm sorry, I can't have this physical manifestation, this live person as a reminder of this horrible assault. I can't. And we would not, my guess is, say, well, you're selfish and callous. We would say, you've been traumatized, and you can't, that you can't have this memory of the trauma in this configuration, we understand. So it doesn't probably analogize. All right, that's what she wants to do between when she talks about this small amount of time, and what she wants to draw from that is that there is a difference, perhaps, between what you might ought to do, maybe, and what you have an obligation to do. On the other hand, when it comes to rape, maybe that doesn't even hold. All right, I think we've nailed it. Thoughts? All right, well, my throat's burning, so I'm not going to even wait for you to have a thing. We're going to cut it.